Welcome to the Brain Science and the Law podcast for Spring 2012 on unique approaches to legal cases involving traumatic brain injury. This is Dr. Valerie Stone from Answers About Brain Injury, LLC. In today's podcast, I'm talking to attorney Ken Jaray. Ken and I talked for quite a while, a fascinating conversation, so this podcast is being posted in two parts. Here in part one today, we'll talk about what restorative mediation is, how it works, and what the benefits are to both plaintiffs and to attorneys. I'm here today with Ken Jaray of the Jaray and Webster Law Firm in Colorado Springs. Ken has pioneered something called restorative mediation. He's a personal injury lawyer here in Colorado Springs, so I wanted to find out more about this approach. Over the years, you've been practicing law for a long time. What kind of need did you see out there for something maybe a little different or alternative to what the system does now?
Sure. I have been practicing for over 30 years, and my practice has been primarily involving representing injured people, plaintiffs, in personal injury lawsuits, as well as workers' compensation claims. And I would say probably the biggest factor for me is I would often talk with my clients, and I'd find out how they're doing, and I'd listen to their stories, and I'd ask them about, you know, how's it going for you? And after I got to know them a little bit, usually didn't happen right away, but after I got to know them a little bit, they'd open up. And I'd find out about the emotional trauma that they suffered as a result of either was a drunk driver hitting them, someone running a red light, you know, someone who did something that was negligent or careless that caused them an injury. And they had some reactions that were typically anger, fear, frustration. They had these common emotional reactions. Then I would ask them, of course, about their treatment and so forth. And what I would find is that there was a high correlation between those people that still had those emotional reactions and were still dealing with significant chronic pain, long-term problems, and so forth. And then so that got me interested in learning about that relationship, the correlation between the emotional reactions and the physiological changes. I started doing some research, and there's a great deal of research out there that says those emotional reactions, particularly anger, can be really harmful to your health. So you put that on top of someone who's injured, and now they have the emotional reactions, it's really difficult to move through that healing process more completely or as completely as they can get, as long as they're holding on to those emotional reactions. The work that I did was okay in terms of it provided them with some settlement, meaning a financial settlement, but it really didn't provide them with an outlet of dealing with those emotional reactions other than the traditional methods of counseling or, you know, those kinds of things. And so what happened, I started investigating something called restorative justice. This was back in 2004. I actually listened to a woman whose daughter had been murdered by someone, horrific murder, and the mother was terribly distraught. She tells the story about over 10 years how her anger and her distraught was just eating away at her. She was really having a really hard time, as you can well imagine. And she was given an opportunity to meet with the offender, who at that point was willing to take responsibility and say what happened and acknowledge his responsibility and apologize. She describes that process as being transformational for her, that she was now able to let go, she was able to forgive, she was able to now reclaim her life by letting go of those emotional reactions. And I said to myself, if she can do that under those circumstances, what about the people that I deal with? What about the person who has that anger because someone ran the red light? What about if they could let go of that? They could practice forgiveness. They could engage with someone who apologized and accept responsibility. How would that impact them? And what we found that it would impact them significantly, the same way it did the mother whose daughter was murdered.
Obviously, such meetings can be very healing. What kinds of cases, then, did you think would be appropriate for a kind of restorative approach within the kind of work that you do in workers' comp and personal injury?
I've been focusing primarily on personal injury cases, and the kinds of cases are really any situation where the offender, or in this case we call it responsible party, is willing to accept responsibility, understands what they did, and is willing to acknowledge what they did. So if you have a situation where two people have a collision, an intersection, and someone says, you ran the red light, and the other person says, no, you ran the red light, probably not going to happen.
Right.
But if you have a situation where it's pretty clear what happened, and that person acknowledges what happened, and I'm saying outside of the context, let's put away for the moment the fact that their lawyers or their insurance company tells them not to say anything. I'm talking about as a human being, they're willing to acknowledge what they did. That's the first criteria. The second is that the victim or the injured party has to be willing and looking forward to having that kind of exchange. Sitting down with someone and hearing what happened, why it happened, an apology, perhaps what they're going to do to change their behavior, if it's a drunk driver or someone texting and driving and so forth. What are they going to do so that this doesn't happen to someone else? And that's a lot of times people are concerned about that. And so you have those two, what we would call screening, meaning that you would talk with both sides and find out those questions. And if both sides are appropriate, the responsible party is willing to meet, willing to acknowledge what they did, say what happened, perhaps what are they going to do to change their behavior. The injured party says, yeah, I'd like to sit down. I'd like to hear what happened. I'd like to hear why they did it. I'd like to hear an apology, and I'd like to hear what they're going to do to change their behavior. That sets the foundation. And then with an appropriate facilitator, you make that happen. It can happen in any situation where those criteria exist. So where someone's careless or negligent, they accept that responsibility, they're willing to sit down, the injured party wants that explanation, is willing to sit down, it's an appropriate situation.
Right.
The injured party, that they want to be able to tell the responsible party, look what I'm going through. That's an important part of this.
Okay, so to tell their story.
Absolutely. Yeah, they want oftentimes the person that hit them to see what they're going through, because that rarely happens. There's rarely interaction between those two people. And it comes down to the basics of relationships. And although you may not know the person that hit you, that was in a car accident, that was drunk, whatever, you have a relationship. The basic thing is, of course, you're both human beings. You both probably live in the same community. That's probably as far as it goes, but you had that momentary connection. And there's no time afterwards in the typical system to repair that connection that's been changed because of someone's actions. And this allows that to happen.
It's interesting that you mentioned the connection to the wider community as well. Can you say a little bit about how restorative justice works to benefit the community also?
Sure. I can give you an example of a small community in Colorado, in Manitou Springs, Colorado, which happens to be where I live. And back in about 2004, our community started looking at these principles of restorative justice principles. We started looking at them in our school district. We started looking in our court system. We started looking in our business community and saying, okay, how are we approaching conflicts, disputes, and offenses? What were we doing? Well, we were doing what most communities do. We were doing a retributive model, which means if someone does something wrong, you punish them. Just through the research that we had done, and many other communities around the country and the world have come before and used restorative principles, we said maybe instead of using a punishment model, a retributive model, maybe we need a restorative model. Restorative means that if you harm someone, you're responsible for repairing those harms. And in a community sense, let's take a vandalism or a theft or some criminal offense. There's harm to the community in the sense of people don't feel safe.
Right.
There may be harm to the particular to someone's property. There's this fear that's been created because of someone's actions. And if that person is willing to acknowledge that and say, I will make it right for my community, it changes the whole thing. It changes behavior, changes people's reaction in terms of their fear, changes the sense of the community when they know someone did something wrong, but they're willing to take responsibility for it, and they're willing to work towards making it right, to repairing the harm. So in the community sense, it really does work. And as I said, we in Manitou Springs, we use it in our school district in a variety of situations, not only student to student, but we use it for property offenses. We use it for drug offenses in both our school district and our court system. And it works remarkably well.
I lived in Australia for many years, mm-hmm. and I did a lot of work with my Indigenous colleagues mm-hmm. in the Department of Aboriginal Studies at the University of Queensland. And they had an interesting perspective on our justice system. Mm-hmm. They lived, obviously, before the Brits came and colonized them in small, essentially hunter-gatherer villages, and they depended on each other for survival. They had to stick together as a community. And so when someone in the community did harm to someone else, they had to take actions to reintegrate that person into their community because they needed everyone, and they couldn't afford to have someone who couldn't play by the community rules.
It's funny you mentioned that. There was an article in the paper today about a professor at CC who I happen to know by the name of Anne Hyde, and she studied American history. And she talks about the same thing back in the early 1800s, how people needed to rely on each other. They didn't rely on the government to punish people, but they needed to rely on each other to resolve the differences, to resolve the disputes that they occurred. And it was the same thing in our country way back when. As government has taken over and said, okay, the government now is going to punish the person or isolate the person from the community, that's what happens. We've changed the nature of the relationship, I think, that we have with each other. And certainly Australia, New Zealand was at the forefront. The Maori tribes used restorative principles extensively. And a lot of our work over here, particularly with juveniles, is based upon the work in New Zealand, the early work in New Zealand. I went to New Zealand a few years ago to study that and try to learn a little bit about what their techniques and their successes have been.
Fascinating.
Yeah.
So obviously there are some differences between restorative justice and restorative mediation, because often the person who caused the harm or the injury is not the same as the legal entity, like an insurance company, that's going to compensate the injured party. So can you talk a little bit about those differences?
Sure. I actually raised a couple different questions. Restorative justice has typically been used in the criminal justice system, and it's used to suggest the example that I gave you with the woman whose daughter was murdered. So she would have gone through a restorative justice facilitation process. We're using the term restorative mediation really to distinguish between the civil and the criminal cases. And restorative mediation was created a number of years ago. I didn't create the phrase, but to indicate that mostly we're using that phrase in the context of a civil claim, meaning a personal injury claim. But there's a lot of overlap between the two processes. In other words, it's using restorative principles, restorative justice principles, in trying to resolve a different type of dispute. In this case, a civil claim, a personal injury claim. But you could also have the same benefit. For instance, I could give you an example of a woman whose son died in a car accident. He was driving with his roommate late at night. The roommate had been drinking. I think they had been partying. And he said, oh, we need to go out and get some cigarettes or something. And wanted the roommate to go with him. So the two of them got in the car. There's actually three of them got in the car. And the driver was just driving too fast. Lost control of the car. Car flipped over, and the backseat passenger, the roommate, was thrown out and killed. And as you can well imagine, the family was devastated. Now, our firm represented the driver of the car in the criminal case. Early on, we recognized that the driver of the car was very sorry, had no intentions of hurting anybody, was terribly remorseful. But initially, when he went through the court process, the criminal court system, he was given no opportunity to say anything to anybody. He was just told to just focus on what you're doing. Don't apologize. Don't do anything. And we realized that he wanted to say something. He wanted to meet with him. And we also learned at the district attorney's office that the family wanted to know what happened. They wanted to talk with him. They wanted to have that interaction. And so we help to facilitate that conversation, that facilitation. Now, there was a separate civil case that was also going on that ultimately was resolved. But the restorative practice took place in the context of the criminal offense, but had application, if you will, to the resolution of the civil claim. Because now the family said, we recognize he's suffering as much as we are. He's a human being as well.
And he lost a friend.
And he lost a friend, and he lost his life. And we feel for him, and they forgave him. And that really set the stage then for resolving the civil claim as well. And so you can use it anywhere along the path, if you will, starting with a criminal, if you want to do it early on, or you can do it in the context of the civil claim as well. If you do it in the context of the civil claim, we would call it a restorative mediation. And if you did it in the context of the criminal offense, you'd call it a restorative justice practice. The reason the restorative mediation, most lawyers are familiar with the term mediation. We use mediation in civil cases all of the time. As a matter of fact, in many jurisdictions, it's required that you go to a settlement conference or a mediation and participate in that. The difference is, hardly ever do the parties meet. In a mediation, in a civil mediation or a civil settlement conference, the parties are kept separate. Very often, the responsible party is not even present during a settlement conference or a mediation in the context of a civil claim.
So who is present?
The insurance representative, okay, acting on behalf of the responsible party. Well, if you're going to restore the relationship, if you're going to help repair the harm, the person that caused the harm needs to be there. And that's the nature of the restoration process. And so we put those two things together, we call it restorative mediation, to deal with both settlement, which typically deals with the financial issues, and resolution, which helps to deal with the emotional issues as well.
Right. You've talked a little bit about this, but how did you get the idea then to bring restorative mediation into your law practice? You had experience in your community in Manitou Springs. Mm-hmm. You saw things happening in your legal practice also. How did that bridge happen?
Back in 2007, there was a significant fire in Colorado Springs that burned down a 300-unit apartment building called the Castle West Apartment. And we ended up representing 60 individuals and families who were burned out of their home as a result of that fire. The fire was caused by an arsonist, but it was also caused by the lax security that the management company, practically no security, if you will, that the management company had with the property. And they guaranteed, they promised, we're going to provide controlled access entries. People have a certain expectation when they moved into this building because that's what they advertised for. And the management company just didn't do that. It became a drug haven. As a matter of fact, in the police community, it was known as a frequent flyer. There were so many calls to that apartment building that the police just were there all the time. And finally, someone got mad at a girlfriend who was there and poured gasoline down the hallways and torched the building on fire. When we started talking to our clients and started hearing their stories, many of them were very angry, as you can well imagine. They had a lot of questions. Why did you do that? You know, why did this happen to this building and to me and so forth and so on? And the civil justice system didn't provide those answers for them. Early on, we suggested to the defense lawyers, we said, this claim calls out for a restorative approach. Unfortunately, the defense lawyers were not interested in a restorative approach. It was probably one of the ugliest pieces of litigation that I've had in over 30 years. It was terrible to see what these victims had to go through again. Not only were they victims from the fire, but they were victims from the litigation process. And I just decided that wasn't right for them. And we eventually resolved that claim. And my partner and I set up a nonprofit organization called the Restorative Mediation Project. We are a nonprofit organization through the Pikes Peak Community Foundation, and we allocated some of our fees to finance this work, saying, you know what, maybe we can make a difference for somebody. We couldn't do it for that case, but maybe we can do it for someone else. At the end of the case, though, we did hold a restorative mediation process, and we used surrogates to actually sit in place of the property manager, to sit in place of the arsonist, and we gave people an opportunity to tell their stories and to listen and hopefully help the healing process.
Sort of a role-playing so that at least they could feel heard.
Exactly, exactly. And for those who participated, we think it was very helpful. And we decided that that would just be something that we would provide to other clients, and hopefully other lawyers would find this to be helpful for their clients as well.
Now, I can imagine that, so the defense attorneys in that case were not interested in taking that approach. I imagine also sometimes there's plaintiff's attorneys who are not interested in the approach. There's real concern about, oh, we can't have an apology in there. That changes everything about the way we move forward with these cases. So what are the kinds of resistance that you get from attorneys, and what do you say to the kinds of concerns that people raise?
Well, let's start with defense lawyers. Clearly, there are some defense lawyers who are going to say that their clients shouldn't apologize. We don't want that to be used against them. In most states, the way this would be structured, it would be done in a settlement conference structure or in a mediation process, and most states have laws protecting against the confidentiality of those statements. So to the extent that the defense lawyer is worried about that being used against them, it wouldn't be used against them later on because of the confidentiality laws in most states. And in particular, in Colorado at least, and in about 36 other states, there are also very specific laws pertaining to medical malpractice claims. So if a doctor apologizes or acknowledges what they did wrong and so forth, those kinds of statements are protected by law in terms of being used against them. What I also say, and I think there's a growing movement in the country towards really wanting people to take responsibility for their actions. We've lost a lot of that accountability and responsibility. And there are a number of defense lawyers are saying that it's okay for their clients to do that, that a jury will be probably more sympathetic with them or more understanding with them when someone comes out and says, you know, I didn't mean to do that. I'm sorry I did that. I'm sorry that it hurt you. There's a lot of research that says that helps the jury process. It helps, meaning that the person's not going to be held financially as responsible as if they come in and stonewall and said, I didn't do that. I think juries like people to be honest, candid, and forthright about that. And so not every defense lawyer accepts that. Clearly that's not the case. They think, well, maybe we can get them out on a technicality or something. But hopefully we're moving into society towards accountability, personal responsibility. And this is just a small step of that. And if they ask their clients, do you want to do that? I think a number of them would say, yes, we do. Very rarely is there ever an exploration about what the responsible party is going through.
It's sort of handed over to an institution to handle for them.
Exactly. The insurance company does everything for them, and rarely is the responsible party ever involved. And so what happens is they may have a lot of shame, a lot of guilt. They also have emotional reactions that one could contribute to poor health, and there's a lot of research, particularly in the medical malpractice area, that suggests that doctors go through an awful lot. They go through an emotional reaction when they've committed a mistake and they're not given an opportunity to say they're sorry or to participate in the process of making it right. It's really hard on them. And so from that perspective, if their insurance company and the defense lawyers look at the needs of their clients, in some circumstances, those needs would include the opportunity to sit down and say, I'm sorry, and take responsibility. As far as the plaintiff's lawyers are concerned, I would suggest that the plaintiff's lawyers do the same thing I did, and that is to talk with their clients about what their needs are. And if their needs are to deal with the emotional reactions of anger and fear, frustration, etc., and they believe that this process of engagement and having the responsible party acknowledge what's going to happen, if they believe that that will be a healing process and they'd like to help their clients with both settlement and resolution and with healing, then they'll offer their clients that opportunity. Now, not all lawyers are going to do that. But the first thing is at least to make them aware of it and to give them another tool in their toolbox that they can pull out and see, is it the right tool for this job given the circumstances of the situation and the needs of the parties. So we think that plaintiff's lawyers can be just be more helpful, if you will, to the clients in helping them through what oftentimes is a very, very difficult transition. The plaintiff's lawyers, I think, can be successful. I think there could be an increase in reputation of plaintiff's lawyers. We can be seen as someone who does more than just getting people money. We can actually help people heal. And I think that's very rewarding for a lot of people.
I think that's actually, in a way, it's kind of an important marketing point. many of the personal injury lawyers that I've met and talked to are, in fact, deeply compassionate people who are very concerned with getting their clients on a journey of healing and helping to restore their lives. And I think it would be great then to have another tool.
Right.
And it is absolutely not the reputation of personal injury lawyers, I think, in the general public, that they do get involved in that healing process. So I think it would be important to get the word out there.
Right. I think you're right. I think there are a lot of lawyers would like to do that. They just, up to this point, they really haven't had the resource to do it. There hasn't been that process set up in the current system that allows them to do that.
So how does the financial settlement work then in cases that use restorative mediation? I assume that's almost a separate piece?
It is. Let's take a case that's brand new. We've determined that the responsible party is willing to participate, willing to accept responsibility and so forth, and the injured party is willing to sit down, wants to sit down, and so forth. We would suggest as soon as that can be determined and as soon as the parties are able to do that, that they get together and have that restorative mediation. At that point, probably the injured party is not going to be ready to settle their claim in terms of a financial sense. Generally, you need to wait some period of time until they're healed or they know the full nature and extent of their injuries, damages, and losses.
Particularly in a brain injury case.
Exactly. But that doesn't mean that you can't start the process of having the restorative mediation early on so that they're not burdened with those emotional reactions as they're trying to go through their healing process. And so they have this early on, they go through whatever healing process they can go through, and then when they're ready, they're maximum medical improvement, they know the full nature and extent of their damages, then we participate in the traditional settlement conference to resolve the financial issues. But what we've done is we've eliminated that emotional burden for them that potentially could harm their health or keep them from healing during the typically 12 months, 18 months, 2 years, or whatever that takes, while they go through their treatment process. So that's in the situation where we would get it early on. In a situation where it's been going on for a while now, and they're now ready to settle their case, we would have a two-part settlement conference. The first part would be what I described earlier of restorative mediation, where the parties actually meet and they have that conversation. The second part typically is done separately, where the lawyers and the insurance adjusters are then deciding, okay, how are we going to repair the harms and what financial resources are going to be necessary from the insurance company in order to do that. And typically that's not done together. Typically that's done in a, what we call a shuttle diplomacy format. But you've laid the foundation again where the injured party knows what the responsible party is thinking and doing and that they're part and parcel of this process, that they're not divorced from the process as they have been in the past. And then the settlement would take place and the parties would go on.
What kinds of benefits do you see to people who have been injured parties from going through this kind of process, either where they do it early on, as you talked about, or where they do it later on?
The main benefit, the main goal of this is really healing and health, to help them deal with the financial resources that they need. That's traditionally done. But more importantly, help them deal with the emotional reactions that very often occur after some type of a traumatic injury, malpractice claim, and those kinds of things. So it's really about restoring them to as close a place as you can, both physically, emotionally, and financially, due to someone else's careless or negligent conduct.
What kinds of benefits do you see to attorneys from taking an approach like restorative mediation?
When we promoted this to insurance companies, we suggested that their insurance adjusters really could be known more as heroes. The same thing applies to plaintiff's lawyers. They could be heroes in the sense their clients would look at them as someone that's really made a significant impact in their life and help them through a very, very difficult time, more than just financially. That they've told them about this process, they've participated with them about this process, and in many cases, they're looked on as heroes. And people thank us for doing this all the time.
I'm sure that's a very good feeling.
It is. We need to get the word out there, but I mean, we need to find just a core nucleus of lawyers who really believe this, and they're out there. I'm part of a group called CuttingEdgeLaw.com. And there's a group of lawyers around the country who said, you know, We think there needs to be an alternative to the adversarial system. There need to be more non-adversarial alternatives. There need to be more restorative alternatives. And there need to be more collaborative alternatives. That the traditional model that we learn in law school about the adversarial model isn't for everybody. We shouldn't get rid of it. We're not going to get rid of it. But we're going to add other resources, other avenues for people that want a more collaborative and a more restorative process to resolve these kinds of disputes, or for that matter, any kinds of disputes. So I think it has a lot of potential benefit for the legal profession, and clearly we hope for society as well.
Interesting. So that's collaborative divorce, that's restorative justice, it's all these different approaches.
That's exactly right. And a number of us met last fall, and we brought together 36 lawyers, judges, practitioners from around the country to talk about this and to figure out, okay, how do we move it forward? What do we do? And we helped to create something called the Integrated Law Movement. And it brings together all of these concepts, collaboration, restoration of non-adversarial process. It integrates them into a dispute resolution model that people can use.
That sounds like a great approach. Thanks for listening to this Brain Science and the Law podcast. In part two, we'll hear about the insurance industry's surprising response to the possibility of restorative mediation. Part two will be posted at the beginning of May. For more information about Jaray and Webster, you can go to their firm's website, jaraywebsterlaw.com. That's J-A-R-A-Y, Webster, W-E-B-S-T-E-R, law, all one word run together, .com. For more information about brain injury and CLE workshops that we offer, go to our website, aboutbraininjury.com. Thanks, and come back and catch part two.